interrupting the current neo-Ukrainian climate-challenged, behaviorally controlled, energy-starved, alien-invaded, nuclear-glowing, postulated cricketism to bring you behind the woodshed. This is Cricketude Busting Episode BTWRLM 648. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport, so get you behind the woodshed. And we may never be free from subversion within the gates, but maybe a key subverter or two may have exposed themselves and is on the way out, hopefully for good. After Turning Point USA outcry, FBI drops the ADL. Controversial over the extremism glossary brings about an end to a decades-old collaboration. The FBI has officially ended its partnership with the Anti-Defamation League, which I call the Anti-Anti-Defamation League, a Jewish organization that monitors anti-Semitism following a surge of criticism from right-wing figures. FBI Director Kash Patel announced the move on social media, stating that the Bureau won't partner with political fronts masquerading as watchdogs. The decision comes after conservative backlash over the ADL's inclusion of Turning Point USA and a group founded by the late activist Charlie Kirk in a now-removed, quote, glossary of extremism and hate. The glossary described Turning Point USA as having a history of bigoted statements, a label that Kirk's supporters reject. The ADL, which has collaborated with federal agencies since 1940, said it, quote, has deep respect for the FBI and acknowledged Patel's announcement. Historically, the ADL has provided data and research on hate crimes and has worked with the FBI on civil rights training. Despite this, recent months have seen increased tension over how the ADL defines and confronts extremism, especially after high-profile criticism from figures like Elon Musk. Kirk, who was assassinated last month, drew both condemnation and praise during his life. Civil rights advocates accused him of spreading divisive rhetoric about marginalized groups, while supporters viewed him as a champion of conservative ideals. The fallout from his death has rippled through media and political circles, with several commentators facing professional consequences for their public remarks. There has been pushback as well on the obscure Christian identity movement also being included in the glossary. Some ADL critics also accused it of blurring the line between anti-Semitism and criticism of Israel's policies, particularly over Gaza and Palestinian territories. The ADL maintains that while criticism of Israel isn't inherently anti-Semitic, rhetoric attacking the legitimacy of Israel crosses the line. Now do despicable SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, Patel. And I really don't care what the excuse is from the government and how it's cutting its long overdue affiliation and influence from those organizations. This severing needed to be done long before Charlie Kirk or Turning Point USA. These organizations have been a source of constant societal division, infringement, and evil. In freedom of association and freedom of speech, there is no line to cross. Official legitimacy, challenging lawful existence, jurisdiction or authority, or extent of that authority, is hardwired into the American experience and establishment. The Anti-Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center are despicable organizations that should be gone. And if not gone, they need to register as agents of a foreign government, and then maybe gone. And they should not enjoy any affiliation or influence within the United States, whether that's in District of Columbia or the several states. Though the latest news is that the FBI just gonned the SPLC from a partnership as well. So that's two less, and time to get to the rest. Because we are not free from someone imposing their tyranny, we're here to unleash you, Hedge Seth tells Force in Memphis. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Attorney General Pam Bondi, and White House aide Stephen Miller went to Memphis on Wednesday to encourage the federal force sent there by President Trump. Quote, we're not here to second-guess you, Hegseth told a group of federal, state, and local law enforcement officers and Tennessee National Guard members who Trump said are deployed to fight crime. We're here to have your back, to unleash you to do your job so you can come home safely. Representative Steve Cohen, who represents Memphis, criticized the wartime rhetoric by the U.S. military on American soil. Even foreign threatening to drench our soil needs to be checked, even if climate change is not about the weather. U.S. Department bans climate change. President Donald Trump declared the concept, quote, the greatest con job during his recent U.N. speech. The U.S. Department of Energy has updated its internal list of words to avoid, adding terms such as climate change, green, and decarbonization. An email sent to the Department's Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy just days after President Donald Trump denounced the concept of climate change during the United Nations General Assembly speech. Rachel Overbay, acting director of external affairs, instructed staff to continue to be conscientious about avoiding any terminology that you know to be misaligned with the administration's perspectives and priorities. So I took away from this words, but not deeds. And you knows them when you sees them. Other terms officials were advised to leave out of internal and public communication reportedly include emissions, energy transition, sustainability, sustainable, clean, dirty energy, carbon CO2 footprint, and tax breaks or tax credits and subsidies. It was also noted that use of the term is not completely banned, but their avoidance is strongly recommended. So this is actually presidential head fake news. In his UN address last week, Trump called climate change the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world, arguing that past predictions of catastrophic consequences from human activity were made for bad reasons and never materialized. Quote, if you don't get away from this green scam, your country is going to fail. And I'm really good at predicting things, Trump said, crediting himself for withdrawing from what he called the fake 2015 Paris Climate Accord during his first term and again in the first days of his second administration. Now, he warns against the green scam while he onshores every piece of infrastructure required to implement sustainability, handing it to the Zionist political movement soldiers to impose in America. And I didn't hear sustainable development as a term in the mentioned list, or the fact that the judicial branch of every state and the federal government promotes the outcomes of sustainable development through the adoption of private organization and positions through the Bar Association, as I've shown numerous times, by private or public rule or policy through the years in this broadcast behind the woodshed. And the Bar Association of members were one of the governmentally connected organizations sued in our 2013 Jefferson County District lawsuit for making war on the laws of the United States and the states under color of lawful authority, which all the defendant parties, including the Uniparty, defaulted. Because climate change is not about the weather, right, Klaus Genghis Khan Job Klaus? So, great covert reset again, Trump says. Let's forbid the sustainable terms now, but not the ongoing execution of function so we can hide the planned Siberian gulag from the people we are serving up. And so the greatest con job, like the great Covey swindle, continues stealthily without notice. Is not making America great again, but destroying her, even if a mere notion to a duped we the people. And speaking, as Trump, through his administration, suggestions of eliminating green and another apparent ongoing treason, U.S. lawmaker warns of powerful people trying to silence her over Epstein, who didn't kill himself. Can I add right here? Maybe even Charlie Kirk. Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene has said that she is not suicidal as she renews her push to have the sex offenders' records released. A step Green says is crucial to exposing what she calls the Epstein Rape and Pedophile Network. If something happens to me, I ask you to find out which foreign government or powerful people would go to the lengths to keep this information from coming out, she added. The people understand what I'm saying, adding, I stand with the girls and women who are sexually abused and raped, period. Every time, all times, Green wrote earlier. This isn't about a pissing contest between political parties or rivals. The Epstein Rape and Pedophile Network must be exposed, and my name will remain on the discharge petition. And I just have a question on this. It's outrageous enough a congressional representative feels she has to post that she is not suicidal to X, no less. But where is the FBI? The Federal Bureau of what? Investigation. Where is the FBI investigation on this threat? Where are the arrests that would have surely come from the homegrown, right, Wolverine Watchman militia? Why hasn't the FBI acted quickly and decisively against the death threats against the name Trump insisted we can no longer speak? And the climate challenge representative must have a good idea who is making death threats. She refers to a foreign country. I wonder which one. I wonder why the powerful people aren't named. One country has thoroughly infiltrated the U.S. government with its chosen infiltrated agents and provocateurs. Any ideas, James? Jesus, Angleton. I guess it could be said that the FBI is decisively acting to aid and abet the death threats of a foreign government, right? Confirmed by the AIPAC Compromise Uniparty and Zionist Prioritizer over America, Kash Patel. And Trump is quite fine with that threat, it seems. How do the Pomeranians sleep at night? And with the failure of the pro forma for standard practice, while bending or changing rules for about everything else, to swear in an Arizona representative who has said she will sign and will be the last one needed to sign the Epstein Files release bill, whose actual allegiance is AIPAC Compromise Speaker Johnson? Indeed, Speaker Johnson's allegiance must be to Israel firster than American first, nor the Epstein's non-client victims. Trump is okay with that too, even though the Epstein didn't kill himself files are a hoax. Was Charlie Kirk, having taken notes, also Epstein because of the cause Representative Green is saying has threatened her? Oh, I said Green, didn't I? Darn, I wasn't supposed to say those terms while we're faking it until we make it. And silencing others, if taking over social media platforms isn't enough to attack Gen Z through Israelified perception management media, one step deeper, Israel bankrolling influencers to boost image in U.S. to the tune of 7,000 a post, as we'll read here in a moment. And who do you think it is that's ultimately paying for the greatest welfare queen to propagandize to your youngins? The welfare queen benefactor and toward evading criminal charges, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Milikowski, has emphasized the role of social media creators in maintaining the country's support base in America. Israel has been paying influencers for social media posts to improve its image in the U.S., according to online magazine Responsible Statecraft. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has recently stressed the role of content creators in maintaining support to the Jewish state. Responsible Statecraft reported on Tuesday the documents filed under the U.S. Foreign Agents Registration Act revealed details of an influencer campaign run by Bridge Partners, a Washington-based consulting firm working for Israel's foreign ministry. And the United States military does not think this perception management against and abusing the children of we the people is a threat to any interest of the United States, showing we the people are not in the interest of the United States. Invoices sent to Havas Media Group Germany, which is managing the campaign, show $900,000 in funding from June through November 2025 for a group of 14 to 18 influencers. The filings estimate 75 to 90 posts in that period, equivalent to being roughly $6,000 to $7,300 per post. The documents do not disclose which influencers were involved. Bridge Partners, co-owned by Yair Levy and Yuri Steinberg, has enlisted a former IDF spokesperson and a former representative of the Israeli spyware firm NSO Group. Last week, Netanyahu told a press conference it was crucial to secure Israel's support base in the U.S. by using influencers, particularly on TikTok and X. Israel's image campaign comes amid declining support in the U.S., particularly over the Gaza war. A recent New York Times survey suggested that 6 in 10 Americans believe Israel should end the war, with more than half opposing additional economic and military support to West Jerusalem. So just let's look at that. 6 in 10 believe Israel should end the war. 4 of those 10 believe we should be warmongers. We need to be killing people. Lawmakers, including Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, have described the situation in Gaza as genocide and opposed additional aid to Israel. But I think we reported behind Woodshed, the UN declared genocide too, and so did the guy behind the Woodshed. And now, Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene is openly saying she is being threatened by a foreign country and that she is not suicidal, and Trump and his FBI are okay with that foreign threat as they turn their woke right guns on Americans, as the article points out. U.S. President Donald Trump, who continues to support the Jewish state. So, America first, Israel firster. And over threats to the American government representatives, for those of you that still believe there is an organic American government establishment. And I suppose you'd also believe the lone gunman Charlie Kirk narrative as we witness yet another pivotal takeover subsequent to that event and continuing extravaganza to garner U.S. support for Israel. And eliminating more. Netanyahu to discuss repeat strikes on Qatar with Trump. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Sunday that he would discuss with United States President Donald Trump whether Israel should launch repeat strikes on Hamas leaders in Qatar. Netanyahu told Fox News that he would prefer to discuss the issue at the White House. They should give him a bedroom there in an office. He's there so much now. Answering the question of whether Israel undertakes not to repeat attacks, the two leaders are expected to meet in Washington on Monday. On September 9th, Israel struck a building in the residential area of central Doha, where a Hamas delegation was meeting to discuss the latest U.S. ceasefire proposal for the Gaza Strip. According to Qatar's Interior Ministry, the strikes killed an Emirates Internal Security Forces officer and wounded several security personnel and civilians. And I think this might have been a bridge too far for Netanyahu. As we watched in the last week what's been going on relative to Trump reinvigorating the Arab world, at least by his statements, unilaterally, it looks like maybe there's going to be a big shift going on. Again, as the commander-in-chief flip-flops his way from one pond to the next, I guess, instead of clearing the swamp he should have done. And after calling Russia a paper tiger, also Trump to drop paper tiger claim against Russia. The U.S. president nevertheless doubled down on his claim that Russia's military has little success to show for its efforts in Ukraine. U.S. President Donald Trump has said he will not describe Russia as a paper tiger ever again after he used the term on Tuesday in Truth Social post. In the same post from Tuesday, Trump also said that Russia had failed to defeat Ukraine in 3.5 years of fighting and suggested that the country is in big economic trouble. He further claimed that Kiev stands a chance to win all of Ukraine back. However, speaking during a meeting with his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, at the White House on Thursday, Trump said that he was not going to ever call anybody, a paper tiger. And hoisted by his own Trump tard, despite somewhat moderating his rhetoric, he appeared to double down on his previous assessment of the military, Russian military, claiming that it has gained virtually no land of late, despite expending considerable material and human resources. By contrast, Russia's defense ministry has been reporting steady advances in recent months, particularly in Donetsk People's Republic. Russian forces have taken control of 4,700 square kilometers and 205 settlements this year, the MOD reported on Thursday. According to Peskov, the Russian economy has demonstrated remarkable adaptability in the face of sweeping Western sanctions, though certain problems exist. The Russian economy has recently showed signs of slowing down compared to a growth of 4.1% in 2023 and 4.3% in 2024. It is still expected to grow to 2.5% this year. In an article on Wednesday, New York Post, citing anonymous White House sources, claimed that Trump's latest dramatic pronouncement vis-a-vis Russia was a strategic move to draw Russia to the negotiating table. Trump tarred indeed. Besides, Russia has been at the table the entire time, and all that time, the United States president doesn't hold any Trump card. In fact, he holds no cards at all. Since taking office in January, the United States president has actively engaged in diplomacy with Moscow over the Ukraine conflict. And thankfully, as you heard me say, not having diplomacy was leading us right up to the nuclear winter. The White House has since initiated numerous rounds of talks with Russian officials, which culminated in a summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Alaska in mid-August. And we're still moving at the speed of diplomacy. As I said last episode, though, it has been said Trump just says things that come from a recent prior conversation he had. I'd be interested to know if he had been talking last week about India, whose national animal is the Royal Bengal tiger, and the Manhattan Mauler tried to paper tiger strike on Russia, thinking it was a deft jab and comedy genius, but quickly found out it in Russia it's a real bear. What do you think? Is Trump tardation mere absent-mindedness or cognitive dysfunction? And upon which to reflect on ourselves in the homeland, from the Department of International Carnival Mirrors, Trump's ultimatum to Hamas, will it break the deadlock? U.S. President Donald Trump gave the Palestinian movement 3 to 4 days to accept his plan for a ceasefire with Israel. What's at play here? If Hamas rejects the plan, Israel would have a justification to intensify its offensive. If it signs up, an agreement in principle is possible, but there are many devilish details that could hinder the process. So listen to that very carefully, what's being promoted, but this is not what that agreement says, so just hold your thought about it, how they're promoting it, and what they're doing. I'll get to the point here to discuss this. There is no rejection needed. And that's an interesting twist on all this, as I'm wondering, again, did Satan Yehu go a bridge too far in his journey to try and expand Zionists' territory without right? And where is it written that Palestinian people must accept any ultimatum from the Manhattan Mauler Mafia? Isn't it rather the fact, law and moral right, that the Palestinian people have a right of self-determination? Right there in the UN Charter. All the nations that go there agree. Where does the Manhattan Mauler's Mafia have the right to use genocide as a bargaining chip? Does a Hamas rejection provide Israel authority to justify or intensify its genocide? And where does the Manhattan Mauler's Mafia have any right to aid an illegal occupying force to further the genocide, to sick its Zionista Federation movement dog on the Palestinian people. And why are the Palestinian people required to agree to conditions with devilish details? Sounds like the Manhattan Mahler is doing the work of the devil, right, Satanyahu? Trump's plan envisions Hamas laying down its arms and no longer ruling Gaza. And since when, other than being a lawless thug, does Trump have a right to insist the Palestinian people are defenseless, having no right to bear arms? Isn't that part of this part of self-determination? The right to abolish? The right to alter? It's written right in the UN conventions. How does the peace faker expect the Palestinian people to enforce their right of self-determination? I mean, Australia knows all about that. Give up your guns, what happens? The UK knows all about that. Give up your weapons, your arms, and what happens? Your self-defense appliances. And what makes people think that the Manhattan Mahler's mafia thinks any more about those rights at home? It's really more the point from the Department of International Carnival Mirrors. What do you think Department of War Secretary Hegseth means when he tells all the U.S. commanders that the military would be used against the enemy within, an undefined enemy within, and despite the nearly 150-year-old Posse Comitatus Act that limits U.S. federal troops in law enforcement activities on American soil? But after Trump said he will target the undefined homegrown, and was it really wise to gather all the U.S. military commanders, every one we're told, including the nuclear football-capable commander-in-chief, into one building? A building we are also told is only minutes away from a lurking, opportunistic, nuclear, trigger-fingered China, Russia, Iran, and Venezuela drug cartel enemy and their nuclear sub-based missiles. Wait, drug cartels with nuclear subs? Well, tomorrow they will, right, Iran? The entire United States military command in one spot is the best recent example yet of military intelligence, if, I say if, the threats were real. Sustainable woke SMART military is not too intelligent. And where an email would have been sufficient. Or were these stupid theatrics the best example of military intelligence actually meant for domestic consumption, deception, and perception management? That the meeting with all the U.S. commanders, the nuclear football-capable commander-in-chief, was intended to inform we the people the U.S. military is going to war, but not with the foreign agent usurpers in the gates for decades, the enemy within, the Gen Z conned scripts, to eliminate them as an impending and impeding political threat. Because there is no actual threat out there. The United States and currently Trump makes up the boogeyman, the dancing machine he is. Boogie down, dude. But we find out from Trump, more specifically, the enemy within is not the unregistered foreign agent usurpers or treasonous government officials, but the homegrown. And anyone Trump or his ear knickers don't like to be part of the deal dealt with without due process. And against the backdrop of Unit 8200 takeover of the impressionably minded Gen Z-centric TikTok, Satanyahu admitting now is an Israeli national security imperative, Israelified mass media, Palantir, Oracle, and a whole host of big tech parasites waiting to track, trace, take citizenship, and extrajudicially rendition you to a far-off land, as Trump has said he'd like to do if it were up to him, or to extrajudicially execute. Do you think Trump is going to take out his unduly genocidal psychopathic Zionist-influenced cabinet as an enemy within to make America great again? How about the completely compromised AIPAC handheld treasonous Congress? Is Trump going to take out all the treasonous compromised criminal Congress critters as enemies of the state within? And if he doesn't, who is he talking about being the enemy within? Any ideas? Will Robert Clayton Dean Smith? then we don't have to wait for an answer, actually, as to what the criteria will be. He has already declared it. The stupid people, remember? Those having a comprehensive awareness and grasp on reality, such that it is, and that think and act accordingly. Trump is attacking the more credible non-APAC compromise representatives that don't agree with him. And then when Trump is gone, who will the new homegrown enemy of the state within will be to be taken out? It's why government in the Constitutional Republic is limited. Administrative arbitrariness and caprice prohibited. And that's what these meddling foreigner tyrants want for Palestine and the Semitic Palestinian people. Trump's plan doesn't extend the foundation required for free people to Palestine. He served them up to a technocratic governance ruled by their original oppressor, the Brits, and globalista Tony Blair, whose Institute for Global Change received hundreds of millions of dollars from Oracle's CEO Ellison, and of which the report continues, Hamas would not welcome a technocratic interim government in Gaza and the expulsion of its armed wing, Saqqara University security expert Fukan Halit Yalku tells Sputnik. The Hamas will not welcome a technocratic government, which is part of Trump's plan. Where did he get that? He doesn't talk about it anywhere else, but he installs it, onshores it, and everybody thinks this is the greatest thing since whatever the greatest last thing was. But you in the land of the fee, the home of the debt slave, will welcome the technocratic governance that Trump is currently installing in the open-air prison currently called America, but soon to be. Is that air you think you breathe, Neo? Siberian gulag, if you don't stop it or avoid it, which won't be easy for the go-along to get-along, not considering this an existential threat to we the people. Because as we peer into that international carnival mirror predicting our fate at home, partial and ambiguous acceptance of the deal by Hamas, or the homegrown, I'll add, would lead to a prolonged low-intensity conflict, Salami warns. Quote, if rejection is categorical, expect Israel to escalate with explicit U.S. backing. But Trump's ultimatum is upon Satan Yehu. And so, with all due respect to Salami, there wasn't really a rejection principle. Trump's just putting it on them. When you look at the agreement, the aid will continue even if Hamas rejects, which they didn't, saying that they hadn't read the proposal. Trump's International Security Force will take over from the IDF, just as is happening here at home, if and you yet still don't see the fact. No acceptance required. It's just foisted on you. Again, where all people have the right of self-determination and to defend against oppression, how does an agreement between two third parties to further, albeit kinder and gentler, oppression, foreign or domestic, provide any right to an internationally law-acknowledged illegally occupying force to transfer that genocide from to a kinder and gentler oppression, and then to be run by a temporary so-called Board of Peace, so-called, headed by a technocratic globalist citizen of the country and monarchy that oppressed you in the first place, or where, independently, that backing is against United States law, or where the Manhattan Mahler's demands for interference involves activities that are dangerous to human life and violate U.S. criminal laws, intending to intimidate or coerce a civilian population or influence government policies through mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping, when by omission he threatens to withhold his obligation and duty to unconditionally stop genocide. All Trump had to do was stop Israel, not cut himself and his billionaire globalist buddies in on the deal. Meaning that with Trump's gangland ultimatum, both Israel, Satan Yehu, and the United States or Trump intend to and are committing terrorism against Palestinians, having no say, no self-determination. Just like at home, if in the great Covey swindle, for one, and its profitable foreign allegiance and public-private technocrat fallout isn't enough evidence, of what we're from the safe and effective government and we're here to help looks like. Also Trump gives Hamas a Sunday deadline. Oh, Board of Peace, now you got a deadline. He says all hell will break out if group hasn't accepted peace plan by 6 p.m. Just what I just read the definition for terrorism is. President Trump said Friday that Hamas must have agreed to a proposed peace deal for Gaza by 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday and threatened the group will suffer more attacks if it doesn't. In a Truth Social post, Trump said every country has signed on. If this last chance agreement is not reached, all hell, like no one has ever seen before, will break out against Hamas, he warned. There will be peace in the Middle East one way or the other. Trump said more than 25,000 Hamas fighters had already been killed as retribution for the October 7th attack on civilization, adding, most of the rest are surrounded and militarily trapped, just waiting for me to give the word, go, for their lives to be quickly extinguished. As for the rest, we know where and who you are, and you will be hunted down and killed, says the peacemaker. And despite a Hamas rejection provision in the ultimatum that Trump's rescue would continue even if Hamas rejected his proposal. Because why? The Palestinians have suffered enough, Trump said. Also, Trump, kill them. But people living on their own land and rightfully defending themselves from an illegal occupation genocide, he says, hunt them down like dogs and kill them dead. Is not making America great again, if you haven't noticed. That all said, and late breaking, Trump unilaterally is saying Hamas has agreed, but it is being reported Hamas said yes, but not responding before seems to me to be a bit clever by Hamas relative to that provision in the ultimatum. This turns the entire operation to Trump and upon Trump, and Satan Yehu cannot blame Hamas as Satan Yehu does to break and has broken the previous agreements he makes. It is reported Trump has ordered Israel to stop bombing to get the hostages out. Trump here, though, is flirting with a big war in the Middle East in the name of peace if this goes wrong. In other words, he asks for the hostages, they give him up, which is one of their bargaining chips. And then they don't get the peace they need or the care. That's not going over very well. All those signers also have another plan going, and as Israel attack Qatar, as they attack Yemen and Iran and plan again for that, it looks like quietly the Arab world is coming together, and why we haven't seen any response is they're being very, very cautious on how they proceed, and they're going to move when they know they can, and part of the evidence of that is Iran's ability to put Israel on their knees in 12 days, and Satan Yehu was screaming Uncle Sam at the 12th day. Everybody took notice of that. Now this strong arming looks like that Trump is doing, and things are moving really too fast for me to really say more about this. It appears that if you look at the unilateral nature of the comments being made by Trump, that he's really trying to push this through on his own. He does have some agreement, but he's got to eliminate that faction inside that's stopping it. And actually, this might be what's needed, but that's only with an optimistic view. The hopium is strong here that it will go the direction that the people of Palestine need. Because where Trump doesn't have any cards in Ukraine, he has almost all the cards for Israel. And I'm hoping that Trump doesn't stab the Palestinians in the back to foment the war Israel wants the U.S. to fight against Iran as this starts to play out. Very interesting set of circumstances developing very quickly here. And as reported last episode, Italy's Prime Minister Meloni didn't just sound like a Zionist, aided genocide like a Zionist. An attack on a flagship of Italy was not protected by Italy. Another universal disgrace. Melania is an embarrassment to the Italian people, as I was pointing out last week, looked like was going on, while Trump stands by to watch while promoting his board of peace. The flotilla gets hijacked. Pirates. By the pirates on the sea here. Israel. The pirates of Israeli supremacy, the West's favorite rogue state, has done it again. The assault on an aid flotilla headed for Gaza broke all kinds of laws, but then again, laws have never stopped Israel. The long-expected, if perfectly criminal, has happened again. Israel's navy has intercepted the Gaza-bound Samud flotilla by force, stopping almost 50 boats and, in effect, kidnapping hundreds of their crew and passengers. In terms of law, which, of course, are never really applied in practice to Israel, everything is exceedingly clear. The Samud flotilla was a volunteer operation to bring humanitarian aid to Gaza, which has been subjected to Israeli genocide for now almost 2 years, and Israel had a clear obligation to let the aid pass. And let me offer, I've heard some discussion about this flotilla being funded by Soros and crew in a way I don't care. See, everybody's obligated to do what they can to stop it. So that Soros wants to step up, good on him. This is one of those things that's a good thing to do. How he would be doing that to stop Israel, when I also hear he does have allegiances, maybe not to the extent of the government that Satan Yehu is in control of, that ultra far right wing, maybe not. But at any rate, I will dismiss the fact that even if Soros did fund this, that it's not relevant for what I've seen and what I've heard about that, and what we were all supposed to do where we can. But then, what to expect from the world's most aggressive rogue state that is not only committing genocide, but also waging regional wars of aggression and running terrorist assassination campaigns in the face of the global public? And Israel has well-established track record of this kind of piracy, of course, having stopped several attempts to bring aid by sea since 2010, sometimes with casualties among the humanitarian activists. Stopping the Samud flotilla wasn't merely criminal, but criminal in every regard lawyers can imagine, and typical Israeli super whopper of legal nihilism, Israel attacked the flotilla ships in international waters where it has no jurisdiction. I watched somebody who actually discussing they wouldn't even have jurisdiction in the zone that they have jurisdiction for this effort. Not relevant to this, because the flotilla was in international waters. What you find off the coast of Gaza, as a matter of fact, are Palestinian territorial waters. The blockade of Gaza, which has lasted not merely for the duration of the current high-intensity genocide ethnic cleansing campaign, but for close to two decades now, is illegal. What? I think it's lasted for 75 years, hasn't it? Because the blockade has been in place for so long, Israel is simply lying, surprise, surprise, when arguing it is a short-term measure covered by the San Remo rules, which summarizes international law applicable to armed conflict at sea. And even in those rules, if they applied under them, as well as Israel, would have to let humanitarian aid through. Finally, as Israel has attacked ships and citizens belonging to over 40 countries, Israel has committed aggression under international law against all of them, and, less obviously but a fact, also crimes under each of these countries' domestic laws, because they apply to those ships, which Prime Minister Melania of Italy just stood down and allowed it. Italy, where are you? People of Italy, where are you with that leader? So far for the law, but then again, Israel is a de facto outside and above the law, that much we have known for a long time. Indeed, Israel could not exist without constantly breaking international law and getting away with it. For Israel, lawlessness and impunity are not luxuries, but vital necessities. The reason why it has been able to exist in this manner is well known, too. It is protected by the West, and in particular, the United States. The latter is Israel's single worst co-perpetrator facilitating its crimes like no other state on earth. Soon, for instance, the recent war of aggression waged by America and Israel together against Iran will probably be followed by a second, even worse assault. They're talking about boots on the ground for United States soldiers, folks, relative to this conjecture at this point. In this regard, what has happened to the Samud flotilla has been a test. Clearly, recent moves by various Western governments, including the UK, France, and Australia, to recognize, in an extremely dishonest manner, a Palestinian state and add some cautious rhetorical criticism of Israel make no difference to their absolute deference in practice to both Israel and its backers in the United States. What seemed like a glimmer of hope for a moment, the appearance of warships from various nations to apparently escort the humanitarian flotilla has turned into just another humiliation. The escort abandoned their charges well in time to allow Israel a free hand. The same Western leaders responsible for this cowardly retreat cannot stop waffling about the need not to reward the aggressor when dialing up the war hysteria against Russia, as they have been doing mightily again recently, from mystery drones to declaring unconstitutional states of not peace to chatter of states of emergency. What about, for once, not rewarding the genocider for a change? But that's hard, isn't it? Once all Western governments are accomplices of Israel, and haven't I acknowledged that before when creating the state itself back in the day at the UN? They're all accomplices. The Samud flotilla will not have been the last attempt to break both Israel's genocidal blockade and its aura of impunity. There is hope because even in NATO, EU, Europe, and the U.S., ever more people understand what Israel really is and what it really does and settle their colonial apartheid state that won't stop committing genocide and ethnic cleansing. Israel's systematic campaigns of propaganda and information war are escalating in response, as the case of TikTok has just demonstrated. But even Israel and its American friends cannot reverse history and an experience that the whole world has made. The Gaza genocide is a fact already. It will not be forgotten. The resistance to Israel will never end. And is the Palestinian right of all people, whether any nation recognizes the fact and protects against oppression, which, in the failure of Italy and Spain and the other nations whose flagged flotilla ships were pirated, cannot bode well for their own landed people in the face of any foreign terrorist. And any of you listening that think that oppression isn't planned for you with your nation standing down to allow the attacks and submission, did no one learn anything from the global warp speed attack? Not different than the king of Tyre in Ezekiel, or the more apropos oppressor, the king of Babylon, or the prince of Persia in the day? Now the evil manifesting through political figures acting contrary to divine principles in presidents and kings or rulers of this era, indicating a leader empowered by Satan and his imposters? If your nation won't uphold law, order, and peace, that we may lead to a quiet and peaceful life in all godliness and reverence, stated in 1 Timothy 2:1-3, what can you expect more than a flaming boot stamping on the face of your sons and daughters? Your sons and daughters, because you, in your complacency and your cricketude, you've made your choice already. You don't care about yourselves. So will they feel the brunt, or, if you will, the burnt, of the boot? It seems plainly apparent the synagogue of Satan, those who claim to be Jews but are liars instead, you can read it, Revelation 3:9, contemptuously rule the world and fallen leaders obey. They obey so much so that the nations of the world are allowing universally acknowledged evil to prevail, meaning you have a better choice to make now, not tomorrow. The way, the truth, the life, and that no one comes to the Father except through me. No, not me behind a woodshed. Through Jesus Christ, me. That you'll read at John 14:6. or choose certain death, eternal destruction, being removed from the source energy field, if you please, forever. The forever of which I understand is a pretty long time if eternal isn't impressive enough. Since the great Kobe swindle didn't, I'm not sure how many more atrocities and wicked examples are going to be offered to us to make this decision. So no time like the present to choose ye this day. And what are some of the existing established conditions the leader should have followed better than Satan Yehu's demonic crusade? Let's not hear it from just an RT author. As correct as Tyrek Amar sounds, let's get a second opinion and refer to a former head of Maritime Section of Foreign and Commonwealth Office and alternate head of UK delegation to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, PREPCOM, mentioning on X. 1. The flotilla is on the high seas and not in Israel's 12-mile territorial sea. Israel has no jurisdiction. 2. The Israeli maritime blockade has been in place for 17 years and is an intrinsic part of a long-term occupation found illegal in the ICJ advisory opinion. Let me really put the more of the authority. The ICJ just didn't give an opinion. They gave what the international law is, and it's being violated. 3, he says, it is therefore not a short-term measure in time of armed conflict as specified in the San Remo manual, the very things the Israelis are supporting themselves with. In any event, the San Remo rules explicitly state that humanitarian supplies may not be blockaded. 5, the UN Commission of Inquiry has already determined that Israel is committing genocide. The blockade is plainly a part of the machinery of such genocide. For reasons 1 to 5, the Israeli attack on the flotilla is plainly illegal. 6, on the high seas, the law applying on each ship is the law of its flagged state. An attack by a state military warship on a vessel on the high seas is an attack on the flagged state of the vessel attacked. 7, acts of illegal possession of vessels or abduction of crew on the high seas should be pursued by each flag state as crimes within their domestic jurisdiction, not only in international law. 8. So the Metropolitan Police and DPP have an obligation to investigate and act over the abduction of persons from UK flagged vessels on the high seas. This applies to each flag mutatis mutandi. That's a Latin term meaning with the necessary changes having been made, that though certain details may differ, the fundamental principles or points would remain. So this is fairly clear. Our RT author got it right. I told you weeks before that similar stuff, not so comprehensive. The expert in the field says the same thing. As I said, look around, see what's going on. Why does Israel get away with this? And Trump is allowing all of it. Again, moving from where Trump has all the cards to stop it to a place he's got none, and can't get rid of that nuclear glow out of the opening of my broadcast. Kiev false flag provocation could lead to World War III, says Zakharova out of Russia. As I've been suggesting and saying, could be happening. Russia is saying it again. I can't stress this enough, how serious, how close everything is, turning on a potential mistake. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman cited media reports claiming Ukraine could be planning attacks on NATO countries in order to accuse Moscow. Does the insanity of this kind of touch anywhere near the maybe 8 or 9 level, but a level 0 to 10, even there? Ukraine is planning a possible false flag operation in Romania or Poland that would escalate into a third world war, Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova has said. In a Telegram post on Friday, she pointed to the reports in Hungarian media alleging that Kiev intends to stage attacks of sabotage in neighboring NATO countries and place responsibility on Moscow. Quote, Europe has never been so close to the outbreak of World War III in modern history, Zakharova wrote. And if you think this woman is messing around or she's just a woman talking, this is not just coming from her. So let's read that one more time. Europe has never been so close to the outbreak of World War III in modern history. It's not just coming from some guy behind a woodshed for all these years. This is now right up front in the notice to everybody. You're messing with fire, a glowing fire. According to the information available, the Kiev regime's plan is to repair several downed and intercepted Russian UAVs, fit them with lethal warheads, and controlled by Ukrainian specialists, send them disguised as Russian drones to major NATO transport hubs in Poland and Romania. Zakharova continued. At the same time, they would run a disinformation campaign across Europe to pin the blame on Moscow and thereby try to provoke an armed conflict between Russia Federation and NATO, she added. In order to carry out this alleged provocation, Russia made Garands, I think they call those geraniums, they deliver you a bouquet of geraniums. These Garand drones were reportedly delivered on September 16th to the Yavorov Training Ground in western Ukraine, which hosts the International Center of Peacekeeping and Security of the Hetman Petro Sagaidatny National Academy. Peacekeeping, folks. The UAV had reportedly earlier been repaired and the Lorda plant in Lviv. Zakharova cited Hungarian journalists as saying that the reason for these actions by Vladimir Zelensky is straightforward. The Ukrainian armed forces are suffering a crushing defeat, despite what Trump says. The collapse of the army, they argued, is no longer limited to the tactical level, but has taken on a strategic dimension. If all this is confirmed, it means that Europe has never been so close to the start of World War III, Zakharova concluded. And so, again, taking nuclear glowing out of my intro just doesn't seem so smart or intelligent right now. I just can't seem to avoid that. And it doesn't seem like there's some, that the crazy people of the world are too afraid of going ahead and pulling that cherry red button, causing it to happen. And I say this to remind us to think clearly about what's going on. Don't get lost in the sweeping media that you hear will be used in case they do that. And if you've been watching the news, it's been going on. There was a big unidentified drone swarm going into, I think it was Romania. Now it's been kind of hush-hush. They stopped talking about it, but Russia says, our drones don't go that far. They had to come out of Ukraine. So listen very carefully on how this is all working out and all the problems that they're going to do. But Russia is saying what's being planned is getting us as close as we have ever been. And from the Department of the Peacemaker report, Trump has approved escalation in Ukraine support. Officials say administration will provide intel for strikes on Russian energy infrastructure. The U.S. is set to provide Ukraine with intelligence for launching long-range missile strikes deep into Russian territory, marking a significant escalation in support amid Russia's invasion of Ukraine sources. Officials say President Trump has approved the move and the administration has asked NATO allies to provide similar assistance to make it easier for Ukraine to hit infrastructure like oil refineries and power stations and pipelines. This is the first time U.S. intelligence will directly support Ukrainian operations aimed at energy assets deep inside Russia. The intended effect is to sap the Kremlin's resources and disrupt its ability to fund and fuel the ongoing war. While the U.S. has previously assisted Ukrainian attacks, this new level of intelligence sharing could enable far more damaging strikes and force Russia to divert more air defenses away from the front. Last week, in a major shift from earlier statements, Trump said he believed Ukraine could win back all the territory Russia has seized since 2022 invasion. The administration is also considering sending advanced missiles, including Tomahawks, which have a range of about 1,500 miles, though no final decision has been made, Vice President J.D. Vance said on Sunday. But it is being reported also that Ukraine does not have the delivery systems to launch the Tomahawks. So this is much be some, maybe some bluster, however, there's still that threat. And the sale of air-launched extended-range attack munitions to Ukraine has already been approved, and Keith Kellogg, the U.S. Special Envoy to Ukraine, suggested Sunday that Trump had already approved long-range strikes. So there are two different elements there. The answer is yes. Use the ability to hit deep. There are no such things as sanctuaries, he said, when asked if such strikes have been given the green light. I thought we were getting rid of green. Trump, what's up with that? No more green. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov downplayed the reports on Thursday, saying that the supply and the use of the entire infrastructure of NATO and the U.S. to collect and transfer intelligence to the Ukrainians is obvious. On Wednesday, Russia ambassador to the U.N. criticized Trump. President Trump is a special kind of politician, Vasily Nebenzia said. He likes quick fixes, and this is a situation where quick fixes don't work. No cards, folks. But they're going to be poking that real bear, since we don't use the phrase paper tiger no more. This is BTW RLM 648. And something potentially worse than a nuclear winter, which eventually ends, if it doesn't kill us, forever chemicals known as PFAS have turned up in an unexpected place. Beer. Toxic forever chemicals found in 95% of beers tested in the U.S. Researchers tested 23 different beers from across the United States and found that 95% contained PFAS, with the highest concentration showing up in regions with known water contamination. The findings reveal how pollution in municipal water supplies can infiltrate popular products, raising concerns for both consumers and brewers. Infamous for their environmental persistence and potential links to health conditions, per- and polyfluoroalkali substances, or PFAS, often called forever chemicals, are being discovered in unexpected places, including beer. Researchers publishing in ACS, Environmental Science and Technology, tested beers brewed in different areas around the U.S. for these substances. They found that beers produced in parts of the country with known PFAS contaminated water sources showed the highest levels of forever chemicals. The test subjects were produced by U.S. brewers in areas with documented water system contamination, plus popular domestic and international beers from larger companies with unknown water sources. The researchers found a strong correlation between PFAS concentrations in municipal drinking water and levels in locally brewed beer. This work shows that PFAS contamination at one source can spread into other products, and that researchers call for greater awareness among brewers, consumers, and regulators to limit overall PFAS exposure. These results also highlight the possible need for water treatment upgrades at brewing facilities as PFAS regulations in drinking water change or updates to municipal water system treatment are implemented. I mean, forget the beer contamination. They're talking about the municipal water treatment system feeding everyone's house. From false flag to false intelligence, I feel at this juncture with all the early adopters of AI, it's important to keep reminding of the limitations, the dangers and vulnerabilities in using the technology. One cannot rely on their own sensibilities to assess the potential harms. As I read this next warning, make a list in your mind that you will apply to every event in the future to more quickly ascertain whether some event is real or fabricated so as to consider a proper action for yourself. It's going to get very difficult. Russia cautions against AI arms race. Tech rivalry without safeguards, quote, could threaten humanity's existence, close quote, Deputy UN Envoy Dmitry Polyansky has warned. The rapid development of artificial intelligence and intensifying global rivalry in the field pose an existential threat to humanity, the ambassador Dmitry Polyansky has warned. Speaking at a UN Security Council briefing on AI on Wednesday, Polyansky called for safeguards and regulation as more countries rush forward with technology. Quote, an AI race, the ambition to outpace geopolitical rivals by rapidly developing a technology that is not fully understood or controlled without sufficient AI safety measures for all stakeholders, could, much like an arms race, endanger humanity's very existence, he said. These technologies pose significant risks and are becoming a new factor that can affect the stability of the entire system of international relations. And here we start the list of events that might affect you to keep in mind. For instance, you see a vid in a video and a sensational or even reasonable-looking assertion. The first question to answer now is this AI-generated? Again, we used to say, just is it Photoshopped? That has to be the very first thing you put in your mind. Was what you're seeing generated by a machine? The Russian deputy warns of some more types of events to gain your buy-in. Polyansky warned that AI tools could sway public opinion and election results by spreading news and fake information on social media, as well as disrupting critical infrastructure. Polyansky said it is premature to raise the issue at the Security Council, but urged debate in inclusive forums, adding that Russia would support a UN-led role in AI governance. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres echoed the concerns of the briefing, warning that the AI can help tackle food insecurity, demining, and conflict prevention without guardrails. It can also be weaponized. He noted that General Assembly created the two new AI bodies last month, a global forum and an expert panel to coordinate governance and cooperation. ChatGPT's debut 3 years ago sparked an AI boom, with investors pouring billions, bravo dollars, into the sector. Public filings show Meta, Microsoft, Amazon, and Alphabet spent tens of billions of dollars this year and plan to invest over $400 billion by 2026. And probably suck all the power out of the country that is being made right now. And those billions have brought more AI vulnerabilities to plan against and prepare to avoid. Experts warn the surge could lead to a bubble and a trigger of financial crisis, while others say the technology itself poses existential risks, from engineered pandemics to rogue AIs without strict safeguards. Part of the answer is to put in your own safeguards. Not AI software programming, but tangible safeguards, like I learned you behind the woodshed and what to do about the great Kobe swindle, or considering a return to using silver or gold coin. Do you realize if we, the people, had done that, we wouldn't be seeing inflation? In fact, in this last year, relative to gasoline, how much cheaper now is a gallon of gasoline to gold or silver? It's quite astonishing. In sound money, things are costing much less today in relation. You could almost say you made money. Gas went up $1 a gallon over the last year, I think, or roughly so. And gold went up over $1,500. Like, what? Yeah, it's kind of like that. We the people are missing the boat, don't you know? Where AI can throw the world into a digital tempest, tangible money can calm the waters. Knowledge of your local communicable disease law and of habeas corpus can cure a pandemic, in quotes. Remember, that was a private term. While on the other hand, AI cannot create a real outbreak or epidemic that may be a direct, non-fraudulently demonstrated risk. Use AI as a tool, but don't let it or some authorita run your life by it or make decisions for you. Don't let the tool run the job. Right, Tim? As they say in construction, measure twice, cut once. Don't cut twice to find you're still too short of what you need. And just when you thought the AI-driven social credit behavioral control system couldn't get any more intrusive, Orwellian nightmare, some public washrooms in China won't dispense toilet paper unless you watch an ad. China, in some respects at least, is starting to resemble George Orwell's dystopian world, replete with social credit scores to control its citizenry and its citizenry's behavior. Now, apparently you can add public toilets to this mission creep. To wit, as per a Telegram post by China Insider, people in some public washrooms now have to scan a QR code printed on designated toilet paper dispensers and then watch the resulting ad on their smartphones to acquire a measly dole of the sanitary paper. You don't get to wash your hands or anything? What is this? A measly dole on top of that. What's more, you heard of austerity, folks. Think about why I'm even reading this story. What happens in this digital gulag they're putting up around us? To acquire the measly dole of sanitary paper. What's more, if you need additional toilet paper or simply want to skip the ad watching process, you'd have to pay 5 yuan or 70 cents. 0.5 yuan or 70 cents. Chinese officials, however, defend this naked mercantilism as a waste prevention measure, one that disincentivizes citizens from using more toilet paper than what might be necessary in the strictest sense of the word. Unsurprisingly, the comments under the China's insider's reel contained copious references to the Orwellian undertones that this measure evokes. Of course, this is not the most extreme measure of Chinese officials have instituted in recent years to regulate access to what should be a freely available amenity. But that wasn't even the intrusive mission creepiest part. Back in 2017, Beijing's Temple of Heaven Park actually installed toilet paper dispensers with facial recognition tech, raising serious questions about user privacy and ubiquitous state-enabled monitoring. Just concerns? It gets creepier. Is it a crime to insult virtual idols? South Korea court says yes. A virtual idol group has won a civil case against a commenter who depreciated their looks online in one of the first such cases related to the rights of celebrities exclusively using digitally created images to represent themselves. For some of you, that's that person, isn't it? Not you. It's that artificial you. The person. Digitally created images now can be insulted. A virtual idol is a form of musical art that has been growing in popularity in South Korea, referring to those represented by digital image whose movements and expressions are tracked through the motion capture technology of real people. The actual face and personal information of the people controlling the avatars are not usually revealed to the public, forming identities that are independent of their actual self. The Goyang branch of Yujin Yongbu District Court in Gyeonggi Province recently ruled in favor of the 5 members of the group who accused the defendants of harming their reputation in the form of an insult and requesting compensation of 6.5 million won or $4,700 per person. That's their avatar, I suppose. While the defendant's derogatory comment posted on X in July 2024 targeted the virtual avatars representing the group members, the court recognized the real persons behind these digital characters and upheld their claim for damages. The defendant claimed that the comments were targeted against fictional characters whose identities were not the same as the actual people behind the scenes. The court, however, said an insult against one's digital avatar should be regarded as libelous against the actual person. The victim should be specified for the crime of insult, but it does not necessarily mean the victim's name or group has to be specified. The specification of victim can be accomplished if the people who know about the victim are made aware who the insults are targeting based on the expression and the circumstances, the court said in its ruling. The defendant was determined to have posted profanity against the group and the people playing the characters in the group whose faces and identities are not made public. The avatar in the era of the metaverse is more than a virtual image, but a way of expression of the user, one's identity, and one's way of communicating with society, the court said in its ruling, adding that the defendant should be compensated for the pain caused by one's expression of discontent. How creepy is this getting? And mission creepier still, towards that government-approved synthetic you, DHS has been collecting U.S. citizens' DNA for years. Newly released data shows the Customs and Border Protection funneled the DNA of nearly 2,000 U.S. citizens, some as young as 14, into an FBI crime database, raising alarms about oversight and legality. Somebody 14 on top of it. Under Trump's renewed executive order on border enforcement, signed in January 2025, DHS agencies were instructed to deploy any available technologies to verify family ties and identity, and a directive that explicitly covers genetic testing. This month, federal officials... Would you have gotten that, folks? Would you have really picked that up? But there it is. That's how they're hiding all this and what they're after. This month, federal officials announced they were soliciting new bids to install the rapid DNA at local booking facilities around the country with combined awards of up to $3 million available. The Department of Homeland Security has been piloting a secret DNA collection program of American citizens since 2020. Wonder why. See how quick and stealthy that was all working together. Actually, just like I said, wasn't it? Operation Hindsight 2020. Now the training wheels have come off, said Anthony Arricas, Vice President of Advocacy of Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights. In 2025, Congress handed DHS a $178 billion Bravo dollar check, making it the nation's costliest law enforcement agency, even as the president gutted the civil rights watchdogs and the Supreme Court repeatedly signed off on unconstitutional tactics. Oversight bodies and lawmakers have raised alarms about the program. Well, just keep ringing your alarms, right? As early as 2021, the DHS Inspector General found the department lacked central oversight of DNA collection and that years of noncompliance can undermine public safety, echoing an earlier rebuke from the Office of Special Counsel that called CBP's failures an unacceptable dereliction. Oh, there's a duty there, isn't there? Dereliction. Very powerful word right there. And yet, on they go. U.S. Senator Ron Wyden has been here the whole time not doing it. You ever hear from this guy making bills to stop this? U.S. Senator Ron Wyden more recently pressed DHS and DOJ, keep pressing, Mr. Wyden, for explanations about why children's DNA is being captured and whether CODIS has any mechanisms to reject improperly obtained samples, saying the program has never intended to collect and permanently retain the DNA of all non-citizens, warning that children are likely to be, quote, treated by law enforcement as suspects for every investigation of every future crime, indefinitely. Rights advocates allege that CBP's DNA collection programs has morphed into a sweeping genetic surveillance regime with samples from migrants and even U.S. citizens fed into criminal databases absent transparent legal safeguards or limits on retention. Georgetown's Privacy Center points out that once DHS creates and uploads a CODIS profile, the government retains the physical DNA sample indefinitely with no procedure to revisit or remove profiles when the legality of the defendant is in doubt. In parallel, Georgetown and Applied groups have sued DHS over its refusal to fully release records about the program, highlighting how little the public knows about the DNA is being used, stored, or shared once it enters CODIS. Taken together, these revelations may suggest a quiet repurposing of CODIS. A system long described as a forensic breakthrough is being remade into a surveillance archive, sweeping up immigrants, travelers, and U.S. citizens alike, with few checks or the agents deciding whose DNA ends up in the federal government's most intimate database, soon to be controlled and scrutinized by Oracle and Palantir and the rest of the billionaire boy technocrats. There's much we still don't know about the DHS DNA collective activities. Thank you very much, Trump. Georgetown's Laberson says, "We've had to sue the agencies just to get them to do their statutory duty. And even then, they flouted court orders. The public has a right to know what its government is up to, and we're keeping fighting to bring this program into the light." And I would just want to remind you of the problem with the DHS to begin with, where it got started, again, after the PATRIT Act. And before that, it was the continuity of government problem. And that's probably why they're hedging on the duty, so-called. They don't think they have one to any of you. And the EU is going to help with that digital biometric identification of Americans, because something in Europe is more important than your freedom. EU to launch biometric entry-exit system for U.S. travelers starting October 12th. Passport stamps give way to fingerprints as Europe quietly rewrites the rules of arrival. Starting October 12th, Americans flying to Europe will encounter a different system at passport control. Nearly 30 countries in the Schengen area are switching to the EU's new entry-exit system, EES, a digital border program designed to replace the traditional stamping of passports with electronic records and biometric checks. The Schengen zone includes most of the EU, such as France, Germany, and Italy, as well as non-EU members Switzerland, Iceland, Liechtenstein, and Norway. For decades, travel within this zone has involved minimal border controls, but the introduction of the EES marks a move toward more structured monitoring of visitors from outside Europe. For U.S. citizens, the immediate change is that the border officers will no longer stamp passports. Instead, personal information such as names, passport numbers, and entry and exit dates will be stored in a central database. First-time arrivals after October 12th will also need to provide biometric details, including fingerprints and a facial image. Maybe they'll get that in the bathroom in China when you go visit there. On later trips, only those stored identifiers will need to be verified. The EU noted, quote, "The passport control officers will only verify your fingerprints and photo, which will take less time." Only, folks, and only for that, for now. Processing is expected to take longer at the beginning, but EU officials insist that over time the system will allow smoother movement through airports and land crossings. As they get this worked up, you have a social post that they don't like and you enter UK. You don't think they're going to know about it? The stated purpose is twofold. The stated purpose, I say. To speed up checks and to ensure travelers respect the rule that allows only 90 days of stay within a rolling 180-day period. The travelers might also encounter self-service kiosks or mobile apps at certain border points, which could allow them to register some data in advance. As the EU explained, this process can be quicker if you register some of your data in advance. Isn't that what the TSA was saying inside the country of the United States? However, every traveler will still need to interact with a border officer, and in some cases, data may need to be collected again. While the EES is about logging entries and exits, it should not be confused with ETIAS, a separate travel authorization requirement set to be launched in 2026. ETIAS will require Americans to complete an online application and pay a fee before boarding a flight to Europe. The new biometric checks will be rolled out gradually across participating countries starting in October, and with full implementation expected by April 10th of 2026. For privacy-minded travelers, the shift raises concerns. Just concerns, folks. Since extensive personal and biometric information will now be retained by European authorities each time an American crosses the border. Sounds like the EU doesn't want any red-blooded Americans to visit, to me. But that's okay. They keep it up, and it's going to be a nuclear wasteland anyway. They can biometric that. And honestly, I don't know why people would go to Europe with that stuff. Why would you? Why wouldn't you find something in your good old America to visit here? And this is what they do before biometric ID with the presumptively criminalizing terrorism act. But keep all this in mind while we're getting our digital gulag certificates. UK police detained George Galloway on return from Russia. The veteran politician has been briefly held at Gatwick Airport under the Terrorism Act. And don't underestimate our PATRIOT Act as a presumptively criminal identity for you. Same thing. George Galloway was temporarily detained at Gatwick Airport under the Terrorism Act upon his return from Russia on Saturday, according to the Workers' Party of Britain. Officers from the Metropolitan Police Counterterrorism Command stopped the 71-year-old former MP along with his wife. The police have acknowledged an incident, but have not confirmed that Galloway was the man detained. Quote, we can confirm that on Saturday, 27 September, counterterrorism officials at Gatwick Airport stopped a man in his 70s and a woman in her 40s under Schedule 3 of the Counterterrorism and Border Security Act of 2019. Neither of them were arrested, and they were allowed on their way, a Met spokesperson stated. The Workers' Party of Britain confirmed in a post on X that their leader and his wife was detained, branding the incident a politically motivated intimidation attempt. The party said it received no immediate information on charges or alleged offenses. Schedule 3, cited by the police, allows border officers to stop, question, and detain individuals arriving in the country for the purpose of determining whether they had been engaged in hostile activity of any sort. Following Galloway's release, his party doubled down on its allegations, condemning the incident as an attempt to intimidate those who seek amity rather than enmity with the rest of the world for Britain. We were obstructed from providing legal support, and to the conduct of the affair has been designed to intimidate political opponents of the drive towards war with Russia and China, the party said in a statement, promising to provide a full account of the events tomorrow. The veteran British politician and former RT show host, Galloway, was an MP for nearly 30 years. He launched the Workers' Party in 2019, and with a social conservative platform, he won the 2024 Rochdale by-election. Just 5 months later, he lost this seat in the to Labour in a general election, which he had been a member for decades before the early 2000s, to which the Workers' Party GB account on X posted, George Galloway, I will never succumb to the death of freedom and liberty in my native land. At Gatwick, he was told, you are under arrest. You are not free to leave, and you don't have the right to remain silent. If he didn't comply, he'd be committing an offense. This is Britain in 2025, the country that once boasted the Magna Carta and of reasonableness and moderation. That day, he knew, liberty in Britain is dying. We must resist. We must rebuild. To which I responded to the ex-post, Freedom is the range of motion within a frame of constraint. Since when did liberty mean being free? Welcome to this dose of reality. Now, what you gonna substantively do about it? When Galloway responded on his broadcast to the incident, not my post, but it was fairly milquetoast. He was shocked to find out he lives in the King's open air prison. It only took him 70 years or so, folks. And as a Siberian gulag is being built, the monopolization continues apace. Google's new development ID rule could harm F-Droid, says open source advocate. But maybe some of you don't even know what the hell that is. But we're looking at F-Droid, which is a place where you can get programs, apps, they call them now, to run on your phones. And we can, what they call sideload, you don't have to go through Google to get your programs or your apps. And there's a couple of other sites. F-Droid's a very popular one. I think, though, they have a high standard for the apps they have. They try to protect against problems with the apps. But Google's new developer ID can harm that F-Droid site to allow us to get apps without having to identify ourselves. A crackdown framed as security could erase one of the last open doors left to the Android world. Google's latest move to tighten control over the Android ecosystem is being met with a sharp resistance from the open source community. Mark Prudhomme, a member of the F-Droid board, has warned that the company's proposal to require identity verification for all Android developers would effectively dismantle F-Droid. He confirmed that the project is seeking regulatory review of the plan and urged both developers and users to press their governments to act before the policy takes effect. So please take note, all y'all. Under the proposal, Android devices certified by Google would only accept apps registered by verified developers even when side-loaded from outside the Play Store. The rollout is set to begin next year. Google maintains that this system is needed to combat malware, claiming sideloading apps carry about 50 times more malware than those obtained through its official marketplace. I can only interject here, I've yet to find a malware there. If you're careful, you always have to be careful. So I guess those of us that are careful don't see this problem. But again, the monopolization, they have their rules and their reasons about how they're going to monopolize the supply to get your ID. According to the company, forcing developers to verify their IDs would introduce accountability and shield users from fraud. F-Droid operates on very different principles. The nonprofit distributes only open source software and has no user accounts, a design choice meant to prevent surveillance of its community. Its volunteer team provides apps from publicly available code, signs them with cryptographic keys, and warns users about unwanted elements such as advertising, proprietary components, and privacy risks. Prudhomme emphasized that these practices create a higher level of trust than Google's own store, where malicious apps have been repeatedly discovered. In a recent post, he made clear that the upcoming rules cannot be reconciled with F-Droid's mission. The F-Droid project cannot require that developers register their apps through Google, but at the same time, we cannot take over the application identifiers from open-source apps we distribute, as that would effectively seize exclusive distribution rights to those applications. He concluded that if they were to be put into effect, the developer registration decree will end the F-Droid project and other free open source app distribution sources as we know them today. For Prudhomme, the issue goes beyond app distribution. He argues it is about user freedom itself. Users should have the right to run whatever software they want on a computer they own. And I just have to interject, this is the problem with not having a rooted phone. Having the root of the phone. That's where Google possesses. If you don't get rid of the Google, if you don't root your phone, get to the basic computer on the phone, you're in a layer above that. And Google controls the one before you get to the hardware. So you have to de-Google your phone. You have to root your phone and get rid of the Google. His stance frames Google's decision not as a safety upgrade, but as an effort to centralize power over an ecosystem that has once advertised as open. Ecosystem, folks, in silicone. Where are those environmentalists when you need them? Although Android is technically built on the Linux-based Android open source project, the system has steadily shifted under Google's control. Google Play Services is closed source, and earlier this year, the company restricted AOSP development to a private branch, only occasionally publishing updates. While much of the source code remains available under the Apache 2 license, the direction of the platform is increasingly dictated by Google alone. The fate of F-Droid now hinges on whether regulators and political leaders are willing to challenge Google's tightening grip. Without intervention, a policy framed as user protection could instead erase one of the few remaining routes of independent software on Android. And those regulations require comment. That's what they're asking for here, I believe. The comment periods that will demand that there's a, for on you, they demand that there's no silence from you. In other words, if you have an interest in this, you need to make a comment. The push is on here to make non-dependent interwebs unavailable. Monopolization of the interwebs by a few corporations ought to be fought. The forced association ought to be fought. The right to privacy is a protected interest. The right to open access is a protected interest. The right to be wrong ought to be protected. And a lot of the things the gentleman said in the article. Find out where to make your comment on this situation and make your comments, folks. Come in as a user and tell them you don't want Google's monopolization. You don't want their so-called protection. Make it an issue. Figure out what you need to say. Do a little bit of study, as I've said. This is where we have some force and effect. I've given you examples of where Jefferson Mining District had force and effect in these administrative hearings. Banking purge. Vietnam freezes 86 million accounts for non-compliance with new biometric requirements. Can I just say right here, run, free, give your money out, run, just run. Get away from the banks. Vietnam is freezing or deleting 85 million bank accounts, nearly half of all the accounts nationwide, for failing to comply with mandatory facial biometric scans, citing AI-driven fraud and money laundering as justification. Can you just see the plan here? You just create the AI-driven fraud by these AI, open AI companies, and you just let it out there, and then on the other side, the government comes in and just secures you and requires all these things. Isn't that perfect? Think how they figured you out is why you have... You're not a spectator. You have to start taking action. This is just an example in Vietnam. Don't think it's just over there. And don't think it's just banking. Transactions over 10 million dong, that's $379, now require facial verification, disproportionately impacting foreign residents and inactive account holders, with reports of people forced to fly back to Vietnam to avoid account termination. Privacy advocates warn this sets a dangerous precedent for government financial control, with biometric data being irreplaceable if hacked, enabling permanent identity theft risks and potential misuse for surveillance and exclusion. So inclusive, folks. Similar to Cyprus 2013 bail-ins and Nigerian's crypto bans, Vietnam's move reflects the global trend of the government's weaponization and weaponizing bank access to enforce compliance, with experts predicting more countries will follow. Proponents argue that crackdown highlights the need for censorship-resistant money like Bitcoin, where users retain full control without reliance on banks or biometric mandates. And there's been a bit of confusion on that story as I was reporting it. I'll give you the link for that. And such as stating the fact check that I will give you, Vietnam has closed 86 million banks and have taken the money because they didn't have digital ID attached. But a careful reading of the prior report, as I just read, will correct those errors. It wasn't 86 million banks closed or money so-called physically taken. It's still where it was deposited. You just can't get at it until you comply with the digital ID requirements. And it was not banks but accounts that were closed. It sounds like a time to just get any fiat out of the banks anywhere and go to the original decentralized money. Gold and silver coin. I don't know why that's not such a big deal right now. Bigger than Bitcoin. One thing I can see about Bitcoin, and be careful, that's being controlled also. It's not decentralized either. Governments peer right into that. Is that it can be transferred by the wire. That's the neat thing about Bitcoin. Any medium you trust could do that. Your debit cards do that as well. So it's already there. It doesn't need all this biometrics. But gold and silver coin, a little bit different. That's more of the old school, isn't it? But it's decentralized. Then it's not trackable and traceable. At least not until you get to the atomic level, possibly. That's not identity, though, is it? How a low-key remark by Putin reveals a deeper economic shift. And I'm going to read through this, and we're going to find out what I've been saying is, in fact, what's been going on, what China and Russia has been doing. Putin's finally come out with it. This is a financial writer here who's been in the business as an editor in Moscow for over a decade, and they're just now seeing what you've been hearing behind the woodshed for all the time I've been broadcasting. The anchor of the global system is shifting from debt claims to real assets, and the implications are profound. During the Valdai speech on Thursday, Russian Vladimir Putin made this following rather dry statement, quote, "It's impossible to imagine that a drop in Russia oil production will maintain normal conditions in the global energy sector and the global economy." It certainly wasn't the highlight of the night, and I haven't seen it in the headlines of any recaps. The statement is, of course, true. Putin is saying, you can't kick us out. But let's unpack this a bit and try to get a bird's eye view on what this mundane statement implies in a much more deeper sense. Not in the sense of counting barrels of oil, the Brent price, but in terms of understanding the shifting tectonic plates. Let's first imagine what a Western leader might have said in the same tone circa January 2022. Quote, "It's impossible to imagine that a country that loses access to the dollars in Western capital markets will maintain normal economic conditions." I don't know if anybody actually said this in as many words, but that's exactly what many were thinking. Now recall the G10 Rome meeting in 1971, as the Bretton Woods established gold peg of the dollar was being dismantled, when the U.S. Treasury Secretary John Connolly famously told his European counterparts, "The dollar is our currency, but it's your problem." It is an off-sided instance of American hubris. In other words, despite its global use in trade and finance, the dollar would be managed for American economic interests. When the collective West placed what were supposed to be crushing sanctions on Russia in 2022 in light of the Ukraine crisis, the idea was again, our currency system, your problem. The message, the dollar will be managed by American geopolitical interests. According to the conventional thinking, being cut off from the dollar system would have spelt doom for Russia. The many forecasters predicting exactly such a dire outcome were necessarily simply Russophobes. They were working within certain paradigm. Without access to its now frozen central bank reserves, how would Russia stabilize the ruble? Without access to correspondent banking in dollars or euros, how would trade be settled? And without access to foreign capital banks wouldn't a funding crisis ensue? This type of thinking gave rise to these types of comments. Quote, "We will provoke the collapse of Russia's economy," in the words of French Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire, about 10 days into the war. But the Russian economy didn't collapse, and in fact, it stabilized far faster than anyone expected. The thing is, Russia oil and gas were still needed. And those who thought they didn't need it, read the EU, found out the hard way that they did, even if the Europeans obscured the ramifications as much as possible through large fiscal support and subsidies. But it is no coincidence that the deindustrialization has become a household word in Europe. And somehow the political will to really clamp down hard on Russia energy never seemed to materialize. All of a sudden we have, from a Russian perspective, our commodities, your problem. The question is now, does this mean we've suddenly awoke to a strange new world? Are we now in a system where access to real things like commodities now trumps access to paper promises like dollars? Western policymakers' futile attempts to cut Russia energy out of the world economy show that they understand only the monetary side of things. They see energy as a source of revenue for the Russian state, revenues thanks to which Russia is able to sustain its war effort. But the economy might actually fundamentally be an energy system and not a monetary system is incomprehensible to them. It is, in the strict Kuhnian sense, a different paradigm. The BRICS countries talk a lot about monetary reset being underway and about how new financial architecture is being created. It is fair to say that some of the rhetoric has been premature and that reports of the demise of the dollar system has been overstated. There have been a lot of checks written that BRICS and the Global South aren't ready to cash. Nevertheless, change is afoot, and what is taking shape has roughly the following contours. Commodities are beginning at the margins to act as system-level collateral. By contrast, up to now, the system relied on trust in issuer and paper claims, dollars and U.S. treasuries, euro-dominated assets. Gold accumulation by central banks has been massive. It is a quiet de-dollarization of reserves. Oil for yuan deals are modest but growing. And what can the commodity seller do with the yuan it receives? Convert them to gold on the Shanghai Gold Exchange. This may not yet be widespread, but the plumbing is there. The anchor is shifting from debt claims to real assets. And this is bad news for countries whose economies are perched precariously atop a mountain of debt claims. And for those that pay attention, I'm not talking to you. For those that haven't understood, the United States economy is one giant debt claim. The fiat currency. It's a note. Evidence of debt. That's what we use as money, not for money. Reading back on the articles, think of this as part of hedge against Western sanctions and the weaponization of the system, and a part recognition that commodities have intrinsic durability that paper claims can't always guarantee. Ultimately, of course, paper promises can be inflated. It's not lost on anybody in the Global South that the dollar has down some 111% against gold in just 2 years, and that U.S. debt seems to be spiraling to infinity. If the current system is one where money, credit, and financial assets are king, this means that constraints in the system are money-related. The crises tend to start with something like a spread blowing out, liquidity drying up, or collateral chains breaking. This is basically a money problem, not a real economy problem. Remember in 1998 Asia currency meltdown, or the global financial crisis of 2008, or COVID, or the U.S. gift crisis of 2022, or various U.S. repo spikes. Such dislocations are dealt with by throwing balance sheets at them. Swap lines, quantitative easing, backstops, emergency loans. In 2022, we suddenly found out that the Russian energy is not just another financial dislocation that can be covered with a swap line or emergency loan. From this, it follows that we need to think in terms of two economies, the real economy of energy, resources, goods, and services, and a parallel financial economy of money and debt. There will always be a financial economy. But we're finding out now that it is the real economy that underpins the financial one, and not the other way around. And you've heard me talk about this when I talked about the tertiary levels of government, and your production is at the bottom. It's the foundational level. And then everything's built up from there. You got your service economy for that right above it. And then you have everything government is and all of its licensees and all that. This is pointing out right here, you have a real economy that underpins the financial one and not the other way around. But here's the catch. When energy is abundant and cheap, and when money holds its value against energy, this energy foundation to the economy can be disregarded. The peak of renewable-based energy transition euphoria in Europe coincided with the peak of Russian supply of cheap hydrocarbons to Europe. A coincidence? The legendary strategist Zoltan Pozdar once wrote, quote, Russia and China have been the main guarantors of macro peace, providing all the cheap stuff that was the source of deflation fears in the West, which in turn gave central banks the license for years of money printing. I would add that this also gave the West license to dwell comfortably in the illusion that the economy is primarily a monetary system and not an energy and real stuff system. Ironically, it was the reliable presence of cheap Russian oil and gas that helped this economic illiteracy fester. Putin did not connect these dots in his remarks at Valdai. The focus of his speech was obviously elsewhere, but the dots are there to be connected, and there are a lot of people in Moscow and Beijing to whom these dots are very apparent. And to the guy behind the woodshed for, well, more than a decade, as I've explained over the years, calling out the initiation and milestone since at least when China started purchasing gold in earnest, when China purchased the purchases that drove that price past $1,000 an ounce. And I said then, we had better follow suit. Get out of the fiat system. Get back to gold and silver coin. Make production great again, along with the appurtenant disposed land. But we didn't. And look where we are now. Oh, did you hear that? Was that the sound of the USS Digital Token Citizenship debt hold being locked behind us in the Siberian Gulag? Maybe it's best we get back to the land and the wealth of its production, quick-like. What do you think? This has been the BTW RLM 648, and I'll be with you next week, Tech Diffs, or Nature Willing.
Echoes call, the hour is near, behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three, how's thunder fierce and free. Pull up a chair, lean in close, lessons to learn, dose by dose. Behind the woodshed, no stone unturned, house words ignite, the airwaves burn. Stand up, listen, it's time to learn. Behind the woodshed, where truths are earned. Law to liberty, the spectrum light, in house court, no place to hide. To burst for unspoken truths and unquenchable thirst. Behind the woodshed, no stone unturned, house words ignite, the airways burn. Stand up, listen, it's time to learn. Behind the woodshed, where truths are earned. So mark the time when Sunday comes, behind the woodshed, beating drums, house voice, a beacon, fierce and bold. Fight the truth. So mark the time when Sunday comes, behind the woodshed.
the woodshed. No stone unturned, house words ignite, the airwaves burn. Stand up, listen, it's time to learn. Behind the woodshed, whips and turns. Voices gathered from near and far, house truths shine like a northern star. A rallying cry in the digital space. Behind the woodshed, truths ace. As the sun sets, the truth still reigns in house works, freedom sings. Join us next week, heed the call behind the